content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And over the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the New York Times and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. The Gateway Arch is an iconic landmark that greets you miles before you ever enter the Gateway to the West, better known as St. Louis, Missouri. My first introduction to this fabled city was in the writings of Mark Twain, and that was many, many years ago. Well, today, writer Jane Smiley is going to return us to her stomping grounds to reveal what St. Louis tells us about America. Her article is found in the October 14, 2019 issue of the New York Times. So I think you're going to enjoy your trip today, so let us begin. I don't think most Americans view St. Louis as a tourist destination, but they should. Even as I was enjoying my fall sojourn, activists were protesting current conditions there, and I could see why infrastructure, housing, and wages need serious investment. But my hometown is still beautiful, still full of unique attractions, and I think perhaps the most enlightening spot in America for exploring what America really is. There have always been racial and economic inequities here. Because Missouri was a border state, both slaves and free African Americans walked the streets before and during the Civil War. In the early 20th century, African American districts had some say in city politics because each city district elected its own alderman, and the mayor was mostly a figurehead. Even now, though, St. Louis is one of the country's most segregated cities, according to a 2017 study. There are significant disparities in investment in the city, with black communities being left behind. African American residents live at a poverty rate over three times higher than whites. When I was growing up in the 1950s, public swimming pools were segregated, public transport was not. And while resistance to integrated schools remained strong, it was not even a topic of conversation, as I recall, when African American students showed up at my elementary school. I was in second grade. And there have long been protests over racial injustice, as there are now. I would say protests are as much a part of St. Louis history as anything else. Clarence Lang, professor of African and African American Studies at the University of Kansas and author of Grassroots at the Gateway, said that as the northernmost southern city and the westernmost eastern city, St. Louis has had peculiar forms of racial stratification. There were inequalities, he said, but there was also interracial civic management involving African Americans and whites. Today, as the city undergoes major redevelopment, Professor Lang said it is occurring at the expense of black working class and poor communities, many of which have been dislocated to declining areas of St. Louis County. Even so, he added, St. Louis is a fascinating place, culturally, and its heritages as a passageway to the west, as well as a transition point to and from the south via the Mississippi River, make it a city well worth visiting, just not during the winter. Perhaps I disagree with Professor Lang on only this. I would say not just during July and August, given the humidity. Well, our drive around town was hopeful, then worrisome, then beautiful, then ugly. I kept my eyes on autumn leaves so lovely in October, but we had to see the forest, too. St. Louisans today don't seem as optimistic as they did when I was growing up, but when I returned, there was a bustling, life-goes-on quality to the traffic, the parks, tourist destinations. People smile, laugh, are friendly. We stayed at the Cheshire, an idiosyncratic Tudor-style hotel across from the southwest corner of Forest Park, the site of the 1904 World's Fair. I remember eating in the restaurant with my parents. I did not remember the Cheshire's Anglophilia, every room named for an English author. I went looking for my favorites, Nancy Mitford and Anthony Trollope on the fourth floor, the more obscure ones, like Elizabeth Gaskell, gave the inn an intellectual air. We stayed in the George Gissing Room, a volume of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire set on a side table. The walls and the corridors were covered with art, including Fuhr's 19th century coaching recollections, knights in armor, young women looking innocent, young men looking stiff. A gas station was just up the street on an island between Clayton Road and Clayton Avenue, and out the back windows were modest neighborhoods of dark brick houses. This was not a resort. All of the St. Louis neighborhoods, some boarded up, some so grand that they astounded even my unimpressible ex-realtor husband Jack from Philadelphia, and some of which were regular middle-class streets bumped up against one another, faded into one another. Every time I've returned, the late 19th century houses have lured me, surprised me, made me look at the real estate pages in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. But what set the houses off, made them seem jewel-like, were the huge oaks and small sassafras and maples and chestnuts and rowans. The hills rose to the trees, displayed them. The houses peaked around them, flickered with shadows. I was there for my 50th high school reunion. Time seemed to have collapsed behind me. Jack and I attended the events, but I wanted to investigate what had not changed. An obvious candidate was the Gateway Arch, which I first visited when it was being built, or still being built, rather, in 1964. At that point, two silver curves pushed toward one another, even as the architects worried that they might not meet. This time, whether they wash it or leave that to the rain, when we drove past, we were struck by its flashing gleam in the bright sunshine. Another thing that hadn't changed much was the Missouri Botanical Garden, founded by Henry Shaw, who was born in England in 1800 and came to the United States to look for a shipment of his family's metal goods that had been lost in New Orleans. He found it, took a trip up the river to St. Louis, set up a hardware store to import his father's products. He was 19 at the time. In 1850, Shaw built himself an estate, started developing his garden. He opened it to the public in 1859. Now the oldest continuously operating botanical garden in the country, it was crammed with trees and plants. As we walked along the paths, I couldn't resist looking at every identifying marker on the trees. Some were 15 feet off the ground. It is 79 acres, every step rich and enlightening. There was a rose garden, an iris garden, an herb garden, a children's garden, a sensory garden. My favorite plant was the chocolate mint. In front of Shaw's original mansion, we peered through the bars at a marble effigy of Shaw. He was on his back and looked like he would roll over on his side. The family destination that had changed the most since I was a child was the St. Louis Zoo. The original exhibit, the flight cage, now houses 15 species of cypress swamp birds, that is, birds that inhabit southern Illinois and southern Missouri, where the Mississippi and the Ohio rivers meet. One of my favorite earlier tourists to St. Louis, Charles Dickens, was supremely disappointed when he arrived at the junction of the rivers. In his book, American Notes, he called the spot a dismal swamp and the Mississippi an enormous ditch. In the 1950s, some of the zoo's animals were housed in small areas surrounded by fake cliffs, others in large cages. There were many shows. I remember lions, elephants, monkeys. But zoos now recognize that they must be a refuge for animals, not a display case. We watched the black rhinoceros. His compound had three wings. He wandered here and there. His mate and his six-month-old offspring were not with him. The hippos drifted about in a giant tank, visible beneath the surface of the water and above it. There were a lot of spots where no animals appeared, although the zoo houses almost 19,000 individuals, including centipedes, armadillos, catfish, giraffes, lions, and woodchucks. I was disappointed and pleased. The zoo has done the best it can to transform itself from a place of spectacle to a place of education. Forest Park, which houses the zoo, is 1,293 acres. It has a golf course where my grandfather used to play, tennis courts, the Missouri History Museum, the St. Louis Art Museum, a theater, a skating rink, the zoo, and the jewel box, an ornate greenhouse built in 1934 and recently refurbished. There is also, as I saw when I crossed the street from the Cheshire Inn and walked around, a thick forest along the southeast end, with paths and huge trees, weeds, falling leaves, probably poison ivy, and signs that said this part of the park was being returned to the wilderness. St. Louis has always had a gustatorial variety. French barbecue, baked ribs with a sweet sauce, schnitzel, and sauerbraten, especially at Schneidhurst Restaurant and Bar, a St. Louis County institution on the corner of Lindbergh Avenue and Clayton Road. Now, the district my parents never took me to was the Hill. Now, this is the Italian neighborhood southeast of Forest Park where Yogi Berra and Joe Garagiola grew up. And I'll insert a little secret here. One of my favorite places to eat. Some great Italian eating going on the Hill. Well, we picked Charlie Ghetto's. The Hill is filled with modest rows of houses crisscrossed by narrow streets. Charlie Ghetto's is a long brick building with a small front porch wedged between two narrow parking lots. And when we entered the restaurant, we felt a little uncomfortable. The spaces were tight and dimly lit. We were told to remove our baseball caps because there was a time when displaying our loyalties could lead to a fight. And believe me, and again interjecting here on my own personal visits to St. Louis several times, lots of good places to eat on the Hill. We, of course, opted for the toasted ravioli, a St. Louis specialty, and when my husband chose the Vieux Cordon Bleu and I chose the 6-ounce filet siciliano, rolled in breadcrumbs, grilled and served with a secret sauce that includes the menu's add cheeses and lemon. We did not expect to be impressed, having been to San Francisco, New York City, Rome. The toasted ravioli was good. Don't have to try that again. Jack's flattened veal was savory and crisp. Good enough. And then my first bite of the filet siciliano nearly knocked me out of my chair, sublime enough to block every other taste memory, at least for the rest of the evening. The only downside was the parking lot had no back exit, and we could hardly figure out how to maneuver between the brick wall of the restaurant and the tail ends of all the other cars. Brick. If there's anything that screams St. Louis, it is brick. And 199 types were made south of Forest Park, not far from the Cheshire Inn, in an area called Dogtown. In this rather small area, a 6-mile periphery, there were at least 14 brick factories. The next morning, when I crossed Clayton Road from the Cheshire and wandered along North Skinker Boulevard, the houses were a panorama of brick choice. I loved the oddest one, one small, square, tannish gold with arches, a second-floor balcony, a red-tiled roof, a fanciful chimney. I was also struck by a simpler house built of red-gold bricks that glinted in the sunlight. The rows of brick houses around Skinker looked old and indestructible, but we saw the downside when we headed into the city. Many brick houses were boarded up. Others had collapsing roofs, smoke stains along the walls. They are much harder to dismantle than clapboard houses. Bricks represent the glory and the danger of St. Louis's history. Many still graceful and beautiful in the middle class and wealthy neighborhoods, but in the poorer areas, their history is a burden and a reminder. My grandfather worked for International Shoe Company in the tannery where they turned the hides into leather across the Mississippi, not downtown, in the huge shoe company warehouse that was turned into the City Museum in 1997. This museum is something I have never seen before, a playground junk collection full of children and their parents designed by Bob Casilli. I would like to say that I knew him in elementary school in Webster Groves, the St. Louis County suburb where I grew up, because he was about my age and that we collected fossils down in Deer Creek. But I can't. Surely he had lots of fun with this museum. The vast exhibition... The vast exhibition, indoors and outdoors, includes old chimneys, salvaged bridges, construction cranes, miles of tile, and even two abandoned planes, as well as caves, a 10-story slide, a treehouse, a Ferris wheel, a castle turret, and the world's largest pencil. It is one of the most popular museums in the United States, but I could only take it for an hour. We wandered around the four floors, watched the kids explore the outdoor balconies. It also includes prominent first aid room, and I could see why. Not far away is the Field House Museum, built in 1845 by Roswell Field, the father of Eugene Field, who wrote Little Boy Blue, and the Gingham Dog and the Calico Cat. Roswell Field was famous as Dred Scott's attorney when Scott was fighting against being re-enslaved in the 1850s. The United States Supreme Court decision against Scott was made public in March 1857 on the steps of the St. Louis Courthouse. Fortunately, Scott was given his freedom that May, but he died at the age of 59, 15 months later. The Dred Scott decision is widely considered one of the worst decisions the Supreme Court ever made. The Field House is the last row house remaining on the street, with narrow, steep stairs and friendly exhibits of toys, books, and the paraphernalia of mid-19th century daily life, and we were the only visitors. And I'll inject here before we continue that once you've toured the courthouse where the Dred Scott decision was made and see all the walkable things, including the baseball stadium, it's amazing what St. Louis has put into a small area, so you would enjoy that, I'm sure, if you like walking tours. Now, back to our article. I prefer the National Blues Museum, she writes, on Washington Avenue. Josephine Baker, Scott Joplin, and Chuck Berry are a few of the many musicians born in St. Louis. The museum offers educational exhibitions, interactive displays, and weekly live music shows and sponsors Blues in the Schools, an outreach program that links social music, musicians, geography, and history. There were photos to peruse, songs to listen to, cases of instruments, and costumes to gawk at. The most amusing item was a flipbook of Chuck Berry doing his walk. The museum is ambitious but friendly, and right next door to the Sugar Fire Smokehouse, an extremely popular barbecue restaurant, where the line goes out the door. The daily hours are 11 a.m. until they run out, and the ribs, well, they're delicious. But there is more to St. Louis than St. Louis. In 1803, at the behest of President Thomas Jefferson, the explorers, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, camped a few miles south of the mouth of the Missouri for about 5 months, unable to get permission to enter St. Louis because control of the territory by the French and the Spanish was still under dispute. They spent their time in Illinois stocking their keelboat. A reconstruction at the Lewis and Clark State Historic Site seemed remarkably small, given that it was meant to carry 23 men and all of their supplies. Then it set out for their landmark expedition in 1804. But maybe the most interesting spot is deeper in the past. The Chuckahkia Mounds State Historic Site, where in about AD 1100, an indigenous group, possibly migrants to the Ohio River Valley, began to build themselves a city that eventually numbered 40,000 citizens. The land is flat, but the soil is excellent and allowed the Chuckahkians to construct 120 huge mounds. The conical ones were for burials, the platform mounds for habitation, and long triangular ones called ridgetop mounds that might have been built for defense or burials. The film and the displays in the exhibition hall were more informative than at any site I've ever visited. But what drew me in the path across the lush grass through the trees between the mounds, a powerful walk. When I was growing up, my school should have sent us here on a field trip. We would have learned that the Chuckahkians prospered for about 300 years, growing maize, hunting the plentiful fauna, and catching fish, building platform earth constructions. Then harvest got iffy. Local resources were depleted. The now too large population began to die off and had to leave. The Chuckahkians were ambitious, and Lewis and Clark were ambitious as well. The Louisiana Purchase also ambitious. T.S. Eliot, Maya Angelou, and Chuck Berry, all born here, were ambitious. Well, the St. Louis World's Fair was intended to teach Chicago a lesson. When I looked at the Gateway Arch again on the way back to my hotel, I realized that I was in what is perhaps the paradigmatic American city. A busy place where history, commerce, art, and geography have often connected and often clashed in supremely American ways. And the Chuckahkia across the river is the main reason, or the main lesson, rather, that I learned, that nature can do us in if we don't pay attention. Wow. Quite a story there, and quite a trip to St. Louis, one of my favorite cities. Well, from St. Louis, we're going to go northwest to a small town, state capital. And this is where the Wild West hasn't been totally tamed yet, if you can believe that. Our writer and guide is Dina Mischief, and the location is Cheyenne, Wyoming. Her article appeared in the July 10, 2019 issue of the Washington Post, and it's part of their ongoing series called You're Going Where? Here we go. Cheyenne is one of the country's least centrally located state capitals. In Wyoming's southeast corner, it's 430 miles from my home in the state's northwest corner. Cheyenne has an airport, but few commercial flights land there. It's easiest to fly to Denver, then drive 2 hours north on Interstate 25. Except for the interstates, both I-25 and I-80 pass through Cheyenne, the city looks like any town USA. As you speed toward it at 75 or 80 miles per hour, depending on the direction you're coming from, billboards advertise hotel and restaurant chains, gas stations, and truck stops. There's little incentive to stop. I drove past it for 10 years. When I finally exited the interstate and visited downtown, which has a very walkable 23-block commercial core lined mostly with historic two-story brick buildings, I found a rough-edged folksiness I fell in love with. Pawn shops, an indoor archery range, and tattoo parlors exist along the Better Sleep Mattress Shop and Guys and Dolls Styling Salon. And then we have craft cocktails arriving there several years ago, but many bars remaining of the sort that don't have windows. Now, in Cheyenne, the Wild West hasn't been entirely tamed. This is especially true during the annual Cheyenne Frontier Days, held this year, July 19th through 28th. And this was founded in 1897, and today is one of the largest rodeos in the world. At just over 6,000 feet of elevation in the high plains, Cheyenne's natural beauty is almost as subtle as its weather is unpredictable. During the most recent 4 days I was there, it hailed on 5 occasions. All of these storms were super localized. I swear one was limited to the parking lot of the NCAR Wyoming Supercomputer Center, and none lasted more than 5 minutes. Within 15 minutes of each one's end, the sky overhead was blue. When Cheyenne's population swells to about 300,000 during frontier days, its usual population is about 63,000 or 67,000 if you include nearby F.E. Warren Air Force Base. It's the largest city in Wyoming. Every time I visit, I think it has the potential to be one of the fastest-growing cities in the country. If a high-speed train connected it to Colorado's increasingly crowded and expensive Front Range, Cheyenne to Denver in an hour, ? But I don't know that Cheyenne wants this. Yes, every time I visit, there are a few fancy new things, but the city doesn't seem to be striving for rapid change, which is just another reason it stands out from other towns in the West. And by the way, Dina Mischief lives in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and she has a website if you'd like to follow more of her writings. It's dinamischief.com, D-I-N-A-M-I-S-H-E-V, dinamischief.com. And you can also follow her on Instagram at Dina Mischief, at Dina Mischief. And she has some great travel tips that are included with her article if you're ever interested in visiting the Cheyenne area of Wyoming. And they've got some local faves and some guidebook must and all that sort of thing. You can visit the state's only tropical forest at the Cheyenne Botanic Gardens. You'll find that at 710 South Lyons Park Drive. Online, you can check them out at botanic.org. That's botanic.org. In Lyons Park, you'll find the garden's 50-foot-tall domed Grand Conservatory, a 30-foot-tall palm tree, and it happily lives alongside orange crown shaft palms, a torch ginger tree, coffee plants, and a strawberry guava tree, among several dozen types of plants and flowers that love heat and humidity. A corner of the conservatory is home to a fairy garden kids often crowd around. Outside are trees from places with a climate similar to Cheyenne's, like Sweden and Tibet, a labyrinth, a discovery pond, and wetlands. Sixth graders from 7 schools created the wetlands interpretive signage, and the Wyoming Game and Fish Department stocked Discovery Pond with fish. And leaving the Botanic Gardens to explore the rest of Lyons Park, you can rent a paddle boat on Sloan Lake, hike the flat 1 mile trail around the lake, or see 37 species of trees on the Lyons Park Tree Walk. The tree walk, the maps are available at the park's forestry office, is particularly impressive. If you saw the sign in the conservatory stating that in 1876, Cheyenne only had 12 trees. That's right, 12 trees, not 12 species of trees. Well, the next place you might want to check out is Flipper's Family Arcade, and this is at 1617 Capitol Avenue, and on the website, you can check it out at facebook.com/FlippersCheyenne, facebook.com/FlippersCheyenne. It's difficult to hear the signature electrical hum emitted by the 650-something electromechanical pinball machines near the front window over the chatter from the attached bar and the beeps, buzzes, and soundtracks. of about 75 modern arcade games. Still, these grand dames, there were no computing systems or microchips in games when these were manufactured in the 1960s, so they're worth taking a look and taking a token and putting one in and playing the game. And when was the last time a spinning score reel tracked your progress? Modern pinballs include the Adams Family, which is the best-selling pinball game of all times, and the rare Circus Voltaire, of which there were only 2,704 manufactured. Pac-Man Smash is a four-player air hockey game with several dozen pucks in play. Because it's set in a high-traffic area in Flipper's main game room, it is reasonable to consider a trip to the bar before you play. In the house specialties, a Flip Fusion, a blue raspberry cherry or Coke-flavored icy with a shot of vodka, whiskey, or rum added. Oh, my goodness. Well, next we're going to go over to 8120 Veda Drive, and there we'll find where Microsoft has a cloud data storage facility that you can't get anywhere near, and it's just across the street from the NCAR Wyoming Supercomputer Center, and you can check all this out at nwsc.ucar.edu. Again, nwsc.ucar.edu. Let's tell you more about the NWSE. It's home to some of the world's fastest supercomputers and offers free guided tours. The computer is named Cheyenne and can perform more than 3 billion calculations per second. In 2018, the most recent year for which there are rankings, Cheyenne was the 36th fastest supercomputer in the world, as determined by Top 500, which ranks them. The NWSC Visitor Center is interactive and includes exhibits on some of the atmospheric research modeling Cheyenne does. NWSC provides computing services to scientists studying the Earth system. In other words, some of the weather forecasts and storm activity that you might see, that's where it's all computed at. Make an advance reservation for a one-hour tour of NWSC's 150,000-square-foot LEED Gold-certified facility. You have to be 14 to do a guided tour, which includes a look inside the 5.34 petaflop supercomputer. That's a speed beyond my imagination. Again, that's 5.34 petaflop supercomputer. And the plant monitors and controls the electrical, plumbing, and cooling systems to keep it running. And some other great places that they have, of course, is the Wyoming Capitol Building at 2301 Central Avenue, said to be quite an astounding place and kind of interesting. Wyoming celebrates Statehood Day July 10th every year, so that's a good time to visit there. Online, check it out at wyospcr.state.wy.us/capitalcomplex/wyomingstatecapitol.html. And don't forget to spell capital with an O because we're talking about the building. That website again is wyospcr.state.wy.us/capital, again with an O, complex, / wyomingstatecapitol.html. And lots of fun there, lots of wood carvings and trompe-l'oeil art was recreated, making the wood that was involved in this Capitol building. Very unique architecture. And it's the 150th anniversary, by the way, of granting women the right to vote in Wyoming this year. So another historic fact for you if you visit Cheyenne. Well, that's going to do it for our show today. We hope you've enjoyed your tour and that you'll listen next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.